Good evening, everyone. This is the Ontology Summit 2011 panel session 5, Strategies for Making the Case, take 1, Thursday the 24th of February 2011. I'm really very pleased that we're able to welcome a quite stellar panel to be talking on strategies for making the case. We have Norman Winarski, who is the founder of the venture process at SRI. We have Denise Bedford, who's a professor of knowledge management at Kent State, with wide-ranging interests in semantics. We have Chris Partridge, the chief ontologist at Borough, with both research and commercial interests in deploying ontologies. And finally, of course, P.P. Yim, the co-convener of Ontology, president and CEO of Sim Engineering, with his interest in supplying cloud computing solutions, as well as all the work he does for us on Ontolog. I left myself out, of course. I'm Matthew West. I'm a director of Information Junction, and we do both consultancy and software development in ontology solutions. And I think that means that the next thing is for me to start with my presentation. And this is Show Me the Money, the benefit tale for ontology. And if you could move on to the next slide, please. This is actually the main slide that I have. I think it looks like there's a build on there, Peter. Could you go through the next couple of bits? If that's going, there we go. Right. The real thing I think about making the case is that you need to find out where the money comes from. And what it is you are doing that contributes to more money and less cost than the alternative. And this is what this diagram tries to show. Ontologies do one of two things. They either provide information or they provide support for information through semantics. They provide information through reasoning. You know, if you have an ontology system, you ask it a question, it gives you an answer. That answer is some information which you are then going to use, and that's the next bit. The information is used in making decisions. The key thing, decisions is where the money is made or lost. If you make good decisions, then you reduce the cost, increase the effectiveness of your enterprise, and if you make bad decisions, then those costs get increased. So, and it's not hard to go around any organization and find out what the horror stories are. And if you start doing some analysis, you'll very quickly find that there was a problem with the information. The most dramatic example of that recently was in the Gulf of Mexico with the BP well that went wrong. When you start looking at that, one of the things that strikes you very quickly if you're looking at it today is that people didn't have good information, and the right people didn't have the information they needed to be appropriate for the decisions that they should have been making. Otherwise, it's very unlikely that some of the things that happened would have happened. So what you need to do then is see how what you are doing with ontologies is going to improve either the quality of information that people are getting or to take decisions or actually provide those that information directly through reasoning applications. Now, with reasoning applications, they tend to be specific to particular situations, and I'm not going to talk about that. But I can talk about ontologies providing semantics to information to help improve the quality. And that's what the next slide is about, slide 3, Peter. So this slide shows the key properties of information, and around that you see some of the ways in which ontologies support some of those key properties. So the properties I've got here are relevance. How relevant is the information to a particular to a particular decision? If clarity is, can you understand what it means, or is it misleading you? How accessible is it? Is it consistent? Do I know where it came from? Was it there when I needed to make the decision? Is it accurate enough for the purpose for the decision that I'm taking? And how was it in terms of the cost and benefit? If we carry on doing the build, you can see the places where ontology adds value. So we have, for clarity, of course, you have what's often called an enterprise data model, but that's just another name for ontology. For consistency is a big thing. It's impressive how often decision makers get faced with inconsistent information in enterprises, particularly large ones. And you'll see that most of the things that are going on are clustered around consistency. So the enterprise data model, the physical data models, of course, the reference data and master data, and the integration architecture. And all of these things have a strong strong support from an ontology and an ontological approach to achieving those things. So you can link through from these things and show how more consistent data is going to improve your decision. You can see how clarity is going to improve your decision making. And through that, you can start to see why worrying about some of these things, which are ontological elements within an enterprise architecture, are going to deliver it. And it's following that trail and making sure you know in the end why this is going to cause better decisions to be made, or reduce the number of problems with taking decisions, that you can quantify the benefits that you're going to deliver. And that's really what I was wanting to say. So without further ado, I'd like to pass on to Norman Winarski for his talk. There's another one. Data quality standards, yes, that's another one that ontology helps with.
Thank you, Matthew. This is Norman. Peter just brought up the first slide. So first let me introduce myself. I'm Norman Winarski, Vice President of Ventures at SRI. I'm responsible for helping build ventures, and of course Siri was one of those. My own background was as a mathematician, a PhD from the University of Chicago, but then over time became more and more involved in running a division and then the business and venture and license aspects of the business. Next chart, please. Sorry for not numbering. This chart is SRI's business model. So very briefly, SRI is about $500 million a year of R&D, most of which is the government. And because of that, and because of the Bayh-Dole Act, where a nonprofit can own the commercial rights of its IP when it does projects for the government, we have basically a reservoir of fantastic IP. Usually our work at SRI is doing cutting-edge technology. Sorry, somebody's on the line. Make a lot of noise, but anyhow. Cutting-edge technology that we can then use to try to create ventures and licenses. The way that SRI rewards people for creating ventures is by giving 34% of it back to the teams that made it happen. And as you see from the charts here, it's the way we create value for SRI. So we're responsible for the last mile of commercialization and to create, you know, wealth for SRI, because we have, unlike a university, we have no endowment. So royalties and equity create that for us. So that's basically the business model. Create huge value from the government programs, own the commercial rights, and in the future bring them to market. Next chart, please. So, sorry, could you go back to SRI's process? Thank you. SRI's process for creating new ventures is very important, and I think it has a lot to do with the case for Ontolog. We have maybe decades of research in technology, usually for the government, as I said. But this process doesn't start with technology. It starts with a venture concept. So a venture concept is a business concept. It meets a market need. It comes up with a technology solution. It identifies the benefits in terms of revenue or reduced costs or just surprising and delighting the customers. And from those benefits, you need to also understand what the competition is. So in the case of Siri, for example, looking at the early part of this chart, the venture concept, we knew that we had a market problem with mobile phones, the market problem of many web services were going to be accessible. By the way, this is around mid-2007. Many web services were going to be accessible by the mobile phone, but very difficult to access through pointing and clicking and browsing or searching. So the problem that we wanted to address was make your mobile phone your personal assistant, your virtual personal assistant. And that personal assistant would be with you all the time. It would know the context, be able to personalize the information, learn your favorites, and so forth. So that became the concept for Siri. We started with a market concept, and I can't emphasize that enough, not a technology concept. And the market concept was disruptive, and it was also highly valuable in terms of not needing to compete with Google and others in the search world, which would have been a very difficult process. This was not a search engine. This was a do engine. And I'll talk more about that. But the next step is of our venture process, just briefly, is SRI's commercialization board invests in these market or venture concepts, not to not like a VC that will do a thumbs up or thumbs down, but instead more like what are your strengths and what are your weaknesses and how can we support your weaknesses. And with those funds, we often only develop the business case and maybe the technology demo and help recruit the team, particularly the EIR. So SRI has an EIR program, and an EIR is an entrepreneur in residence, which we bring in to help lead a venture. Usually this is a serial entrepreneur, previously been successful in leading a venture, and comes in from outside. Next, we bring these venture concepts to an advisory board of venture capitalists who give us advice. They have no preferred rights. They're just helping us make contacts, access customers, recruit people, and so forth, and then we launch the venture. So that whole process from venture concept to new venture is about can be about 6 to 9 months is all. And in the case of Siri, it was about 6 months. Next chart, please. So this chart now is the chart labeled Siri, the simplest way to get things done. And that really was the important element of this. By the way, I was, as part of this, I was on the board of Siri, helped create it. The founding team was Dog Kitless, who was our EIR, Adam Shire, and Tom Gruber. And we also had a researcher from EPFL, DDA Guzzoni, who was immensely helpful and quite capable in ontology development. And a good part of the resources that we needed in technology came from the active ontologies that he and Adam worked on. We raised investments from several venture capitalists, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes, but it was very much a competed round in the beginning. We had something that was very exciting, and the venture capitalists knew it. We actually launched the venture in January of 2008. The product launched 2 years later, in February of 2010, and then it was bought by Apple literally 2 months after that. Next chart, please. So this is just a restatement that the paradigm was doing. You know, this is not a search engine. This is a do engine. The Siri will make reservations, not give you links. It'll buy tickets. It'll find hotels and help you make your reservation there. And it's something that we always had as a theme to surprise and delight the customer, by the way. So this was the beginning of a great deal of excitement. A lot of it also, by the way, came from the excitement from the Kalo program that SRI led. And if, for those that don't know it, Kalo was the cognitive assistant that learns and organizes, originally envisioned as learning in the wild. You know, how do you learn? How does machine learning occur when information is just real time? Let's go next to the next chart. Siri's approach. This is really important. It was natural language input. This is what excited people. By the way, it started as a venture with only text-based. That was how we introduced it to the venture capitalists. But shortly after, we realized that we could use speech engines such as from Nuance or VLingo and be able to gather, be able to go to voice. And actually, that delayed the launch by about 6 months, if not longer, so that we went to the speech as well as text. Answers and not links, as I mentioned. The ability to access multiple web services, call upon them, have their answers mashed up, and deliver back to you. That was the value proposition. I am highly personalized. Next chart, please. So this is an example of, we don't need to go into it, but make me a reservation, remind me to call Steve. Find me a hotel with a pool and a fitness center, you name it. This was Just Ask Siri. Next chart, please. So let me go into some questions that I think you all have that don't get captured well on charts. The first one is, what enabled this? What I think you might agree with is a great success. I can't reveal what it was bought for. But we had no, driving need to sell that company. This was a company that we thought could continue well, but we had an offer from Apple that the board decided was going to be a very valuable offer. What made the success so phenomenal? First of all, it has the major three ingredients for a venture. And if you want to have a great venture that's funded by the top tier venture capitalists, you need three ingredients. And for those that are already part of that world, forgive me for repeating them, but the first ingredient is a stellar team. Hopefully somebody that's done it before, but a terrific team that has at least a CEO that's highly capable, charismatic, capable of leading and recruiting the great people, and a VP of engineering or a CTO, and hopefully also someone in the business, marketing and sales. That kind of minimal team. Actually, in the case of Siri, we started off, as I said, with Dag Kittles, who, by the way, came from Motorola, the X-Products group, and he was quite spectacular at Motorola. And even though he had not been an entrepreneur before, he was obviously very impressive. And then Adam Shire joining as VP of Engineering. And then Tom Gruber, came in as CTO. So the first is the team. The second is a great market concept. Remember, this is not a great technology concept. A great market concept. often what we would like to call a disruptive market concept, something that disrupts the existing ecosystem of the market, together with a disruptive technology solution. That is the ingredients of a great venture that all venture capitalists need, the team, the market, and the solution. So just one last point about that is you can't create a great venture by starting from technology and saying, you know, we have the best technology. What can we do in the market? We'll figure that out. That does happen on a rare occasion. But when we create ventures and when we work with venture capitalists, that never works for us. So next question I want to answer is, how did the Siri team make their case to VCs and so forth? And what was compelling? Well, we made the case, we did have this market concept, and Adam had a technology demo that he put together, actually rather rapidly, where the demo was shows the natural language query into web services. And that's essential. People have to believe that the risk of the technology is not great, and that's an important part of making this a success, was proving that the risk was not great. In fact, I mean, the biggest issue that the venture capitalists had with us was people have been promising this for decades. It's always a decade away. What makes you think it's now? And the answer is that we were beginning to be part of the convergence of a major theme, of major trends, that all make this possible now. One trend was the mobile phone, its computing and its connectedness. In fact, the first phone that Siri started working on was the iPhone 3G, and 2G, and that we actually couldn't launch with. It just wasn't powerful. Finally, we got to the 3G, and that did. Beyond the bandwidth and the processing power, there were web services with APIs associated to them. So you could call upon them without having to do the massive amount of work. And in fact, Adam's story was often about using the active ontologies that would enable you to create or add new web services and then use all the existing and previous services as part of the mashup. And everything becomes available to the new service as you add it. So this story was believed. Also, of course, the Kalo program gave it a lot of credibility, about $150 million or more of U.S. government funds going into looking at real-time learning and cognitive assistant that learns and organizes. And so that led to venture capitalists actually competing to fund the first round. The first round was funded for $8.5 million with a $10 million pre. So that's an $18.5 million valuation just at the launch. Then there was a B round, and 3 months later, the company was sold. So I'd say that the greatness of this opportunity, which doesn't happen that often for SRI, I mean, we've launched Nuance, Intuitive Surgical, and Siri, and a few others that were really home runs for us. But the important part about all of this is motherhood, in a sense. It was a great market opportunity with a great technology solution and a great team. And when you have those three ingredients, the venture capitalists and the money is never a problem. So thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much, Norman. That was very interesting.
Thank you.
Denise, are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay, the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. And thanks, everybody, for inviting me to join this great panel. I'm enjoying the other presentations. I'm going to take just a slightly different approach, but I think I'm going to emphasize the same points that Norman and Matthew have emphasized. I'm going to just talk about how you talk about ontologies to essentially the business side. Because the business side of any organization is where I think you're really going to get where you need to get the support, where the funding is going to come from. So, Peter, if you could move me to slide number two. I'm going to use an example of master data management as a way of talking about ontologies and helping to get them adopted. I think most of the people who are listening today are engaged in developing ontologies, and that's been my role. I've also played the role of business architect and a knowledge architect. Most of us have a role in what I would call business infrastructure. In other words, we're developing a solution that's going to solve a business problem. Most of our expertise is in designing and building the solution, which in many cases might be overall formed ontology. It's very easy for us to, because ontologies are so interesting to work with, and they can be a lot of fun, and we can really get into developing the ontologies, I think it's easy for us to forget what the end game strategy is. So I think the one thing I would emphasize is keep in mind that the ontology is not a project standing alone, but it's a solution which is used to solve a business problem. And that, I think, is a point that has been made many times before me today. Slide number 3, please. So it's all about talking to the business. And my experience working at the World Bank for 15 years and trying to make the case for solutions that the organization really didn't want to take on, that they really needed to take on, was to focus on the role that the ontology or whatever, you know, if it was enterprise search or if it was semantic analysis, to focus on the role that that was going to play in the business context. Right now I'm engaged at the World Bank trying to help make the case for knowledge architecture, which is even harder than making the case for an ontology. The administrators only care about whether or not your proposed approach is going to solve their business problem and their business problem today. So if you want to win the argument, your solution will not be a generic solution. It will rather be a business-specific solution. So I have found that if you talk to somebody about ontologies, you get the eyes glazed over. But if you talk about how your approach, your general approach, will solve their business problem, and I think as Matthew suggested, how it will do it efficiently and effectively, then you've got their attention and you have a chance. But always focus on the end game. How does the ontology fit into the larger business solution? And if you're talking to enterprise architects, you need to talk to them about how this is going to fit into the overall architecture in a sustainable way. So I've found, my experience has been that you need to have multiple stories ready, depending on who you're talking to. And there are multiple levels of conversations that you need to have within the organization. There is one conversation to have with the IT folks, another conversation to have with the enterprise architecture folks, and then another one with the user experience design folks. These people, in my experience, are not yet convinced that an ontology is the best solution to their problems. So this is one of our first challenges, I think. Slide 4, please. One of the areas that I think we have a quick win with ontologies is what's called master data management. By master data management, we mean those methods and tools that help us to manage both structured and unstructured data using essentially controlled authoritative values. And these are very often institution-specific. So the purpose of master data management is to provide authoritative control over the collection and management of data to facilitate access, quality assurance, traceability, maintenance, reliability across the organization, and in particular across all of its applications. So master data management generally focuses on the core entities of an organization, and it defines a standard set of attributes and values for those entities. So, for example, and we all look at these and think, gee, these are natural ontologies. A business manager, in my experience, a CIO or a CTO will not make that connection. They're going to think country, regions, employee ID, organizational unit, business process, et cetera, Oracle database. say so, or I need to have those things managed in SAP. Next slide, please. So, two simple truths in terms of the value of ontologies. Well, every organization really should have some form of a master data management operation. Not every organization can afford MDM because it can't afford a large technical team, and generally it's the technical team that supports. And the second truth is, while we'd like every ontology to be universally applicable, a well-developed ontology can be business-specific, and it can have maybe even have the greatest value there. So an easy win for moving ontologies into the mainstream function in organizations is possibly to use them to manage the organization's master data. I think if you look at the ontology tools that are out there and the methods that we use to develop ontologies, they very closely mirror master data management tools and methods. But from my experience, there is a substantially reduced level of investment required to do this the ontology route as opposed to do it the Oracle, the Irwin, et cetera route. So master data management may be a way of enticing an organization to consider this approach. Slide six, please. So for example, you could take country. Okay, so an organization will have its own list of country names, values, et cetera. And it will have, it has a whole data model around an entity that is country. You can build and maintain it in Oracle data sets and Oracle data classes where one of the biggest challenges there is access. So access is going to be highly restricted. The user interface is not going to be terribly easy to work with. There are limited dimensions for building out the ontology, and the rules are going to be stored someplace else. They're going to be another application in LinkedIn. If you take the ontology route to maintaining your country entity, you have classes and rules developed possibly by non-programmers, so you have greater sustainability in terms of just managing that. Access may be permission for different types of users. You have a much better interface and generally a more user suitable working environment. Also, you can build the rules into the ontology structure. Next slide, please. So in the last year, I've worked with two organizations developing ontologies that are intended to serve as a bridge between internal document management, intranet, external web, etc. Making the case to move forward with an ontology at the organizational level was very hard. In fact, I think the CIOs of those organizations did not buy the ontology approach. However, once we said, but you could use this for managing your master data across the organization, then there was great interest. So just, looking at the application in terms of an end game for the business sponsor, it can make a big difference. So once they saw the relevance of the of ontologies to the larger business problem, then there was not as much resistance, and actually you had quite a bit of buy-in. Slide 8. So my advice, and this is what I learned over the past 15 years, or maybe even longer, always speak to the advantages of using an ontology to accomplish a goal, the end game for the business. Be ready to translate what an ontology does and how it does it to the way the business sponsor thinks, what they're familiar with. Understand the business context and the ontology role. If you never say the word ontology, or if you only say it once in your spiel, that's okay. That may be good. In fact, if you restrict yourself from using the term ontology, it may force you to actually, focus on the end game. And make a case in comparison to what they're using today. So make the case that this approach will be more cost effective, it carries a lower risk to the organization because it's accessible and sustainable by a larger community of people. And I would also say stress the role of using ontologies to achieve interoperability. And next slide, and thank you very much. That's all I was going to say today.
Yes, thank you very much, Denise. I certainly recall in my time in Shell applying ontology and ontological principles to master data management. Much as you described there. Okay, next we go on to Chris Partridge. Be pragmatic and be opportunistic. Are you there, please, Chris?
Matthew, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh,
the floor is yours.
Okay. I think most of what I'm going to say has been said before, so hopefully I will say it in a slightly different way to make it more interesting. Also, I think I have a particular tack that's probably closer to the SRI talk than some of the other talks. So can we go on to the first slide? I was really trying to work with the title for the session, Strategies for Making the Case. And I think one of the issues is making the case for what. And so, for example, I believe the Siri, which is disruptive, is slightly different from the master data management solution that Denise was talking about, which I think is probably less disruptive. She might disagree, in which case I withdraw that. But it seems to me there's less disruption involved. So I think that you need to work out really what kind of a solution, what kind of ontology you're going to make the case for. One of the problems, I think, and that's, we can go to the next slide, is that I think there's some confusion about the benefits that come from the different ontologies. And I think that it's sometimes, I know when I've worked with marketing people, I sometimes find they don't understand the technical aspects of the solution, and I've noticed that they find that quite useful when they're in the process of selling, because they can quite happily sell benefits that don't belong to the particular technology that we're trying to deliver without any qualm or whatsoever, because they don't really understand the differences. And it seems to me that there is some of this happening in the ontology market, because ontology covers a range of different things. I point out one example there where a particularly large client gave a demonstration, and they were under the impression that as long as they had an OWL file somewhere in their system, this guaranteed interoperability between a range of legacy systems, which in my experience isn't the case. And I think this making this claim helped them to, if you like, get the work started, get the project started. The problem that I feel in the medium term is that overselling, by using hype, is this undermines trust, and it could have an impact on the way in which ontology will go. If we're not clear about what the different forms of ontology are, what the different forms of technology are, and how do we deal with this? And I think there's an issue for the committee here, is that how do we ensure that people make a reasonable case without interfering with their opportunities for funding? And I think that's a difficult call to make. Can we go on to the next slide, Peter? I think this is, again, almost everyone has made this point. There isn't really a commercial case for ontology. Ontology is just a tool that is used to solve a problem. In fact, it's probably a range of tools to solve a range of problems. The area that I'm interested in, one of the areas, is legacy modernization. And I think that really brings a whole different set of challenges to, for example, the ones that were posed in the Siri example, and probably a different notion of ontology and a different set of tools. So I think that you need to work out what particular case you're making and what particular tool that you want to use. And I think there is someone else made this point. There was a point made to me almost 20 years ago by a marketing agency who used to do Crossing the Chasm marketing advice, is that if you have a tool that's got 101 uses, you can't sell it because people won't understand it. You've really got to pick your use and your problem in order to, if you like, make the sale. Next slide, please. The other thing that I've come across on making sales is where people have said to me, if this is really good, why aren't all the market leaders using it? If it's really good, why aren't there 101 sites using it? And I think you need to look at where ontology is on the diffusion curve to understand what's going on. And I think at the early stage, there won't be, by definition, all the market leaders won't be using it, and there won't be 101 sites using it. And also, I believe as well, and I think there have been some exchanges and maybe a year or so ago on the Ontolog mailing list, it won't be altogether clear about how you can measure it. I mean, you can do your cost figures and so forth, but if you're trying to, if you like, get a handle on the benefits, in the early stages, this isn't clear. And in my personal experience, one of the things that you need to work on is selling a vision. And I think in the Siri case, they came up with a marketing proposition. I can't remember the name that was used. You need to be clear what that is and work on that. You also need to work out who you're selling to. You need to work out someone who is able, from a limited set of facts, to work out what it's going to look like. I mean, if you're an early majority or a late majority, you tend to look at what other people are doing and sort of fill in your picture of what's going to happen from what's happened to them. At the innovator stage, you don't have that. And the other thing, and another piece of advice, is you can work on greed and fear. So you can say, look, where you are coming in early, you have a chance of making a bigger benefit. And also, if you don't come in early, you miss them. So there is an element in the sale of being clear about the elements of greed and fear that's involved. And the other thing that I believe, particularly when you're at the innovator stage, is that you have to some extent to be opportunistic, is that if you look at the history of some innovations, there seems to be two stories. There's a story of where they worked out a brilliant strategy and implemented it, and there's the other story, which is they just happened to be in the right place and the right time and took advantage of the situation. And it seems to me there is an element of opportunism with these things here. You can make yourself lucky to some extent by positioning yourself, but in the end, when the opportunity presents itself, you need to mold yourself to the opportunity. No, I think that's the last slide. Okay. So I think I've just merely, if you like, given from a slightly different angle, points that have been raised by previous people. So it seems there's some consensus here. Thanks.
Yes, thank you very much, Chris. That's very useful. Peter, are you ready to go?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. Let me bring up the slides. Okay. Peter Yim here. I'm surprised that looks like the whole panel agrees with one another so much that I mean, it's amazing that we are generally talking about nearly the same things, but from different perspectives. We have people from major industry, from a research organization, from a venture perspective, and we keep on coming back to the same nuggets. The talk I have prepared is called Science and Technology That Changed the World, Beyond Good Work, Marketing Stunts, and Logic. Of course, I mean, we all know, I mean, if we want to change the world, or if we need to be doing good work, we need to sell this stuff properly, market it properly. And since we're doing ontologies, logic is important, and we sometimes tend to think that if we logically proceed, we'll get where we want. And I agree all these things are important, but in this talk, I will probably mention a few more things that goes beyond those fundamental needs before we can really make our case, or before we can even see ontology as a science or as a technology get into the mainstream and help change the world. So I'm going on to slide number 2 now. Again, like what Chris really that good? I mean, is it the solution that will solve people's problems? The other panelists have addressed that very well. And even if we do have that, a good solution, are we marketing it properly? By marketing, I'm not talking about selling it, but rather, I mean, are we packaging it into the right products? Are we timing it correctly and things like that? And lastly, I mean, that's the sales pitch. I mean, do we know how to pitch it, or who do we have to pitch it to? Several of the panelists have already showed us that. I mean, there are multiple audiences and multiple messages that needs to be pitched. Going on to slide number 3, beyond good work. Of course, the intuitive answer is, I mean, if we have a good product, or if we have good technology, we will be able to make it. But the true answer is not quite. About like 15 years ago, I mean, back in 2006, when I was a research fellow at the Institute for the Future, a bunch of us actually came together and put together a piece called Technology Filters and Lenses that would help us identify what might be important in the future. Of course, Institute for the Future is a sort of futures research organization. I mean, no futurist will claim that they can predict the future, but everyone will say we will try our best to map out the possibilities so that people who are making decisions or people who are trying to avoid risk could use those inputs to help them make a better decision, just like what Matthew was saying earlier. So the bunch of factors or filters and lenses that we were able to gather included, like, do we have the right people? So, I mean, this maps exactly into what Norman was saying. You have to start with a good team. When we were discussing this point, it involves more than just the good team of people within yourself, but rather, I mean, are the right people involved in that? I mean, even in the peripheral, we're just take for instance the same product, an iPod, let's say, coming from the hands of a Steve Jobs may be very different from it coming from, let's say, a equally or successful person like Bill Gates. So sometimes, I mean, you need the right people to bring together success or to create the necessary environment to get successful technologies into the mainstream or into the market. Repeated again, is the application must fill a strong need. I mean, and we can't start from a technology. Third bullet is we have to look at the install base. There's a tyranny in the install base, which particularly solutions like what we can provide with ontologies. We are all new kids in the block and on the block, and the install base is going to run us over. So one will have to be extremely careful on how to find the niche to get in. Otherwise, I mean, we'll never sort of come out when there's a huge install base. Of course, when we look at whether technologies are going to be successful, we'll look at whether it actually overcomes current limitations, because that helps. I mean, if everyone is making, let's say, a 100 megabyte drive, and you manage to make a 100 gigabyte drive and a hard drive and at the same cost, I mean, you stand a much better chance than if you are just marginally in par with what is already in the market. Then we also look at market readiness. I mean, is the market ready to take this? With ontologies and a lot of the newer concepts, sometimes the market is not ready. It takes a few more things to line up before the market is ready. Technology capacity. Again, there are various models to model market readiness as well as technology capacity, and we run each of the prospects through those models to see if it will actually be able to be important in the future. Timing, again, a very important element. And then the environment, global, social, and economic trends. I mean, you can have the same technology that Facebook has. I mean, if the social trends, global social trends, or the timing is not right, then maybe you don't have the kind of success that the Facebook is seeing. Or, I mean, if one remembers things about like book readers or iPad equivalent type products. I mean, it's not even a different company. Apple had sort of the same product. I mean, but maybe at the wrong time and it never came off. And last but not least, one needs to be lucky because, I mean, there's a lot of very capable people doing very interesting things and things one will need some luck to get off and become very important and change the world. Going on to slide number 4. In this day and age, we almost have to be sensational to be heard. Siri did it, I mean, in a very successful way. I mean, we for those who were there, we had this wonderful talk given by Tom Gruber and Adam Chia shortly after they launched their product February last year, and everybody was blown away. I mean, at the call, because it was sensational. Again, I mean, the recent buzz is what Watson was able to do at this Jeopardy game show, and everybody again was blown away. These were great marketing stunts. I mean, it's done so well, it's amazing. I mean, it will go into history as being extremely important landmarks. I mean, in the development of AI technology and various things that are near and dear to us. But beyond marketing stunts, we have to ask ourselves, I mean, who are we making our case to? I mean, that same question was asked by several of the panelists before. And Matthew and I actually sat down and mapped out a few key audience in the constituency. Actually, Matthew will be sending out a post to the Ontology Summit mailing list and ask people to really come up with different messages to these different people. And the six that we've identified here are policymakers. I mean, if it is not in a strategic direction, we're never going to make it. So we need the buy-in of policymakers. Obviously, the next bullet is we need the buy-in of whoever holds the budget. we need the buy-in of the technical decision maker, the CIOs, the system architects, and so on. But that would be at a higher level. Then we actually need the buy-in of the lower level technologists, I mean, namely the software engineers or the developers, because even if they are given a marching order, there are many ways they could implement their solution. Why would they need to use ontologies? That's why we need probably a very different message to these people. And, of course, we want to sell the users and the consumers of the technology just the same, because in the end, they are driving the needs. And if they are not sold, it sort of falls back to all these previous people shortly after. I mean, even if they had made a decision that to go with ontology, and if they don't see the uptake in the users and the consumers of the technology, they will give up. And lastly, and very importantly, even if everyone wants it, we don't crunch out ontologists overnight. And education is a leading process to our ability to produce them. And that's why we need to sell educators so that they could produce the right people with the right skills, so that when the needs are here, the skill sets are available. So I would invite everyone to look to look out for Matthew's post when we start asking people to help us refine the message for each of these different audiences. And of course, if there are other segments of the audience that we have inadvertently missed, tell us. So going to slide number 5. Okay, beyond logic. Why does it still feel like we are at a loss? I mean, if we look at major technologies, the internet, I mean, personal computing, I mean, the integrated circuits, I mean, all these things take like 20 to 25 years, to be an overnight success. The type of techniques, I mean, artificial intelligence, ontologies, and so on, actually have taken much longer. If we remember, I mean, where it all started, let's say the Dartmouth Summer Research Conference in AI in 1956, we lamented, I mean, when we had the first ontology summit back in 2006, we lamented that it's been 50 years already. And we still feel like we were starting. Oh, why is this so? I think beyond all the regular answers we can think of, I mean, I think Thomas Kuhn might have the answer in his 1962 work called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and I guess most in this audience would know. And of course, when he came up with that, it introduced some fields as a circular argument on the fact that, I mean, the paradigm shift would not be understood by people within the same paradigm, and which he rebutted with his 1969 postscript, which I think is just phenomenal reading. And I guess we'll have to be sensitive of this, and in our strategy towards making our case, be aware that we are trying to sell a scientific revolution. And the process or the way to do that may very well be very different at least to some audience, as we were to sell a business solution. And on that note, I recall sort of the a soundbite that I posted. We were asking people for sound bites, and Matthew says, I mean, we have to come up with an example. I sort of wrote this one over, and I said, ontology promises to be the driver for the next paradigm shift. And if you think personal computing and the internet have been disruptive, wait and see what ontology can bring about. So on that note, I pass the floor back to Matthew.
Thank you very much, Peter. That was very stimulating. Okay, well, the floor is open to questions now. What I'd like you to do, please, is use the soap hub to raise your hand. You'll find down in the bottom right-hand corner, just above the send button, that there's a ZZZ for going to sleep, and next to it a hand button. If you could push the hand button to indicate that you want to ask a question, then I'll call people up as that happens. If you had a question which you put on the chat board, and you think that's not yet been answered satisfactorily, stick your hand up for that as well. There was one point that was that came up that Chris raised that I thought was quite interesting, and that was about master data management not being disruptive, and I think that's quite true. It's interesting. There seem to be two ways, two streams almost anywhere. One of which is doing what you're doing in a better way somehow. And master data management is one of those. People have master data. The question is, how well do you manage it, and can you manage it better? And that's an incremental way of applying technologies. And then there's the disruptive technology, which is the Siri example is a really good example for. Todd Snyder, would you like to hit *3 to unmute yourself and ask your question?
Matthew, I guess this question is more for the Track One gang, in that, how are they going to apply these wonderful words of wisdom to the application framework?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because I think that I think it was one of the things that Peter was saying, is that you have different areas of application and different audiences. And you need to tailor what you are saying. I think that particularly if you went back to what I was saying, which is about following the money, for each of the applications that they come up with, application areas that they come up with, there will almost certainly be a different money trail, which is, you know, how can you show how this is adding value, and what are the other components that are essential to make that happen. Are there any other panelists that would like to chip in on that question?
Well, getting back to Peter's presentation, he identified the stakeholders very clearly and succinctly, and I think Norman also alluded to some of them. But for the application framework, we probably have to identify the priority of stakeholders for each particular part of the framework or category.
I see a matrix coming on. Thanks, Tom. Was there any other panelists that wanted to respond to that question?
Peter here, if I may. Right. I think it's sort of a different way to slice and dice it. One common situation we run into actually is whatever you say, I mean, an ontology can do or will do, someone will say, it's not the right solution. Reason being, and as I believe Chris and others have pointed out, because ontology actually can provide that wide a spectrum of solutions. It's always someone who would say this is the wrong solution. Therefore, I think the ontology framework people will be able to help us by identifying what approach is needed to solve what problem. If one goes back to Matthew and I mean, through the help of Steve, was thinking of, inviting Clay Shirky over to lead the opponent side of the debate, because Clay is sort of famous for his article called "Ontologies Are Overrated." I mean, he has a point. But he is not addressing the entire ontology spectrum, and he just say, if you use this kind of ontology, he actually was more talking about like structured vocabularies and controlled vocabularies, and he said, those that does not provide certain solutions. Of course not, because that's not even the right approach. That's why I think if the ontology application framework people would set us up with, what do we need? Assuming we are not sort of talking about just formal ontologies, but the entire spectrum from of ontologies from, let's say, controlled vocabulary to fully axiomatized first order logic ontologies, then we should also have a sort of very clear layout of, what should be applied to what problem. And once we have that, then we can rebuttal, or at least we can answer challenges much more easily. And I think that's sort of a separate, it's slightly orthogonal to the breakout of the audience. Even with each solution, we still have that, that audience. So a multi-dimensional matrix would almost be inevitable.
Yeah, that's coming up on the on the chat room right now, in fact, Steve Ray and Rex Brooks in particular. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, thanks, Peter. Al Stevens, if you haven't already done so, if you hit *3 to unmute yourself, and then if you'd like to ask your question, please.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
One of the points Norman made that was the importance of the demonstration in selling Siri, and I haven't heard that point so much. And in my own work, I've certainly found that one of the ways of cutting through quickly to a point where people actually do believe that you have a solution that addresses a real problem is to produce a compelling, focused demonstration. And I'd be interested in the other panel members' experience with demonstrations in the process of selling the utility of ontologies.
This is Denise. I would totally agree with that. You've got to have at least a proof of concept, because things have been oversold so much in the past, unless they can actually see something. You know, going in with a PowerPoint is not going to do it. Absolutely agree.
So I agree as well. This is Norman. If you have a disruptive solution and you just claim it and you give a PowerPoint, it's not particularly impressive. People actually want, and actually this happened in the Series B. Series A was a demo. Series B, venture capitalists wouldn't invest until they, and this was prior to the launch of the product, by the way, until they were able to use it and see how well it worked. Now, at the A round, that's not true. You just have to demonstrate feasibility. But you have to demonstrate it, in a way that's credible. And one last point, you shouldn't be going to venture capitalists or other business people if you're far from that opportunity. If you're really just demonstrating something that's canned and not capable of executing on your plan, that goes back to haunt you.
Yeah, I agree as well. This is Matthew West here. Certainly in Shell, you had almost no chance of doing something big. No one was going to let you bet the business or even a sizable part of it on some new piece of technology. And going through a series of initially demonstrators and then small implementations before and demonstrating success at each stage before going on to large implementations is just the only way that anything ever happens.
Yeah, just one caution again is you shouldn't be demonstrating a technology absent a great market case. And it's a solution to a market problem, not a technology seeking a market problem.
Sure.
That's a very important point, yes.
Yes, well, that certainly makes sense to me. I was really commenting that a number of the ways of arguing seem to focus a lot more on a more abstract approach, and I'm glad to hear that people see that role as demo. And I like the elaboration that the demo should be real, not canned, and that you may have to progress that demo through various stages of the process and make it progressively more real as you move along.
Right, and you can have it real, that very limit, just to show that you've reduced you've actually had a solution and you can extend it now. You don't have to solve the whole problem in the beginning, but enough so that it's highly credible.
Hello, this is Rex Brooks. I wanted to ask if we could come up with that, and I think Steve's already answered the question, but maybe on a practical sense, I'd like to see us come up with a set of use cases and problems that we can solve and maybe put that into a matrix and maybe even make it a cube or however many sides to it we need, a sequence of matrices if necessary, where we can get all of these various factors together in ways where they relate to each other and give us a way to test the application framework and to develop metrics for how we go forward and do things that we can measure and prove are successful.
Okay, yeah. Leo?
Okay. Yeah, I'd just like to underscore a couple of points here. I agree with Peter that you have to pick out exactly where on the semantic, if you will, spectrum you are. I think applications are dependent upon the kinds of models that you're using and the expressiveness. And it's also the case that if you portray everything as an ontology that's in that spectrum, you're really going to lose credibility and trust, which gets to Chris's point earlier. We have an obligation, I think, to maintain the correct definition, provide, as precise technical a definition, a set of definitions as possible for what ontologies are and what semantic technologies are, including that spectrum. Otherwise, if everything goes and you just have an ALF file in your system somewhere, and you think that that's going to be magically enable you to be interoperable, when people discover that that's not true, they're going to think they've been bamboozled. Just another question is the about a prototype or demonstration. One of the issues, of course, is that ontology is largely infrastructure. So when you have a demonstration, we've done a number of demonstrations, you have to talk about what's underneath. In other words, there's going to be a graphical user interface, and you're going to maybe have queries, and you're going to have maps and bells and whistles. But you have to tell people that the substance is underneath, enabling the application to run and the data to be integrated. And they won't understand if you just have a blank screen and you enter a query and a bunch of information comes back, even if it's a nicely rendered in graphics. So there's still a large burden of education and discussion that's required to tell people what's actually going on.
Yeah.
But Leo, wouldn't you agree though that trying to have that discussion with some on the business side, the message needs to be crafted?
This is Norm, and I agree. But the first and most important thing you have to demonstrate is the use case you're working on. So, you know, in the case of Siri, it's make a restaurant reservation at, you know, Il Fanaio, and at 7 p.m. tomorrow night, right? And you have to show that working. So that already demonstrates many of the key features of the use case, which is, you know, you go from a natural language sentence to a speech recognition to identifying the slots that need to be filled and filling them and mashing them up and returning information. Then I also agree, once that answer happens, and by the way, then you compare it with your competitors, you know, what would happen if you did the same query with Google or Bing or anything like that, then the next step is to say, okay, now let me show you why this works and why it's better, because we are more accurate, we can remove ambiguity, we can increase the certainty of what that query really was about, and we can learn over time.
That's good. Okay. Bruce Musicus. Your question, please. Star 3 if you are muted.
Yes. Am I coming through?
You are indeed.
Great. I'm relatively new to the field of ontology, and I guess listening to all this, I'm a little confused about what the term covers. When I look at Siri, I see a system which surely has some ontologies underneath. What sold it, I would guess that the VCs never heard the word ontology. They heard natural language understanding and semantic understanding of what was said, and maybe they heard form filling and the idea of carrying along this idea of where you're located and interpreting in that context. Is what sold it
Bruce,
ontology, or was it a solution?
Yeah, so Bruce, a good question, but Adam really did demonstrate to the venture capitalists the approach of the ontology and why it was so superior to other approaches.
Okay.
In other words, by using the ontology, you know, you could maintain certain types of information across many different queries that you couldn't have done in other approaches that weren't ontological based. So he used it as a way of showing a disruptive solution. In other words, that's a separate question, which is, you know, okay, this is a market, this is a solution. Why is it a disruptive solution? Why can't anyone do the same thing that you guys have done?
I think there's a more general point behind this as well, and that is that it would be unusual for an ontology to be the solution. It's much more likely that it's going to be a component of the solution, and hopefully a vital one. Okay, Rex, you were wanting to ask a question.
Can you hear me?
I can indeed.
Okay, I wanted to point out, I put a note in the chat asking for input into a matrix. Todd and I will put together, it may turn out that it'll just be a place where you can, you know, fill things in, and I'll build the matrix offline. But I'd like to see is use cases with specific problems and, you know, with identifying the kind of you know, use case it is and what the specific problem is and how it might be. And so we can find out what kind of metrics we can then use to measure how effectively we do solve that problem, if we do. But beyond that, I think we can also coordinate with, as Steve told Chad in the chat, we want to coordinate with the application framework folks to make sure that this is, you know, coordinated and synthesized all the way through so that the information we pull out of that is used in the application framework.
Yeah, no, that sounds excellent to me. Certainly critical you know, you need to know what you're making the case for when you're making the case. And it's certainly, it's from, you know, solving a particular problem, which is what you have to build that around.
Yeah, and Todd actually came up with the notion of a matrix first, and I'm borrowing from him. And I'll be working with him as well.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Peter, your hand's up.
I have a couple more observations that maybe we can bring up and have the group discuss here. One of the major difficulties, despite the fact, I've already mentioned that it's related to what Thomas Kuhn has pointed out, is the fundamental nature of ontology as the science and as the approach makes it extremely difficult to understand is maybe one or two or three steps removed from the solution. This is a point in time that I was trying to make the case, and I was pulling an analogy that maybe during that conversation was relevant, was that it's difficult when you try to sell a business solution when what you're trying to sell is, for example, mathematics or arithmetic, because like what Denise and Chris said earlier, ontology is not it. I mean, it's not what we're selling. So just like arithmetic is never what you're selling. I mean, you definitely be using arithmetic or be using algebra. I mean, in a huge number of things, but that's never what you're selling. I mean, unless you're in the business of writing algebra textbooks or something. So this is, I think, one challenge. And without sort of a good ability or good way to address that challenge, we still run into difficulty trying to explain what ontology is. But maybe Denise is right. I mean, maybe we don't even want that word, O word, anywhere. However, I remember at ISWIC, the International Semantic Web Conference 2009 in the Washington, D.C. area, they actually had a panel discussion saying, should the semantic web people do away with ontology altogether? And obviously, the answer came out to be negative, but the attempt was I think, kosher. I mean, one should really look back and say, I mean, how do we tell people about something that is so fundamental that would be in every solution they would need and that could actually address all of their problems, I mean, in some way. I don't think we have a succinct message for that quite yet.
Well, I was just thinking, probably we need a sticker that you can put on things that says ontology inside, like the Intel sticker.
Okay.
So it's not an ontology, it's a PC, but it's got ontology, it's got it inside somewhere.
Wow.
It's a vital component. Oh, here we go. That's ontology on board.
Yeah.
Okay, Leo, you had a question.
Just to respond to Peter's comment, and indirectly a couple others. I think there's a real issue discarding and not clarifying what ontology is and relating it to other technologies. Because what will end up, and this goes back to previous discussion points too, scientific revolutions, etc., how new ideas become more predominant and eventually, you know, let's say thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, if you follow that paradigm. So one of the issues is that everyone at any given time has, if you will, a set of technologies they know about, if they're technical people. And mainstream technologists will know about mainstream technologies. And so one of the issues is that if you don't differentiate and define what you're doing and show the distinctions, on the one hand, people, let's say, in XML technology, which we know came from, you know, HTML, hypertext, and if you will, the database community. They'll reinvent everything that ontologies and the technology associated with technology with ontologies have developed. So I see this trend, for example, in XML, where they develop constraints and constraint languages. They're developing rule languages. They're pushing their structural model, if you will, into semantics, saying it's actually semantics when it's not. And this happens so many times, you know, this is why the communities have been fragmented. In a sense, it's like technological stovepiping. And so that's one of the issues that you're going to, without firm definitions and understanding, people will think, well, you know, I can do this with my XML.
Yes, whereas ontology does not equal XML, but I
right.
So positioning, that's about positioning things architecturally in layers, isn't it, amongst other things. And with ontology actually sits in a different layer than XML.
You could still use XML. In fact, you know, what we suggest is you generate XML from the more expressive ontology side. And there may be other downstream products that you want to do that. You may want to create documents or spreadsheets or Java docs or et cetera.
Yes, it's not one of the things I've noticed is the way over the last 10 or 20 years, you would have things where everything was wrapped up together. The technology, any ontology, any implementation environment, the whole thing would just be wrapped up and tied very tightly together. And from what you see over the years are layers being stripped out of this so they can be distinguished and layers treated discreetly and replaced discreetly once you've done that. I think finding the right place for ontology in that kind of layers approach in the right it would be a useful thing to do from an architectural point of view, because that helps. Because certainly one of the things I was doing in Shell was trying to get ontology onto the enterprise architecture map in the right places, and to be able to point at things and various things and saying, look, you know, that stuff over there, that's really ontology-based. And starting to get it in, a bit of drip, to get people thinking that they needed to take ontological approaches to various areas, or look at ontological-based solutions. Yeah. Okay. Robin's got their hand up.
Alden.
Yes,
Alden. Yes.
So in listening, I mean, I'm thinking about things that might have been precursors like, that we could build a case on. And in a sense, you know, one thing that pops in my mind when we're talking about ontology, it's a little bit like if you're, say, back in the 1700s and trying to sell calculus. I mean, you know, ultimately, you know, if you're an engineer, calculus is, everything has calculus inside, you know, everything is, you know, but if you're trying to sell calculus, ultimately you sell calculus to engineers and other people as how it's successful in a whole bunch of different applications. And ultimately, calculus, you know, started off in its main application, if I remember correctly, was like mechanics, celestial mechanics. And then as, you know, things were, as it succeeded there, people, you know, it took off in other places. And so I'm thinking, you know, if we use that kind of as a model, we really need to focus on one, I don't want to call it a killer app, but one place where it can really succeed, and that'll start as a seed. Because I think I'm worried we're kind of confounding, you know, like when you talk about theory, you're talking about a specific concrete thing. But when you're talking about ontology, you're talking about a whole class of things. And so, you know, there's that kind of distinction I think we have to be aware of.
Well, yes, now I think that's quite good, because that comes back to one of the points I was making a bit earlier. You've got that there are two kinds of things. There's this disruptive kind of thing which theory is all about, and there's what I would call the bread and butter. And when you're talking about, you know, what calculus is to engineers, calculus is bread and butter to engineers. And the thing with ontology for me is bread and butter to is information management, and in particular things around integration and master data management that Denise was talking about. For me, those are the sorts of things that are the bread and butter things. They're not exciting in the same way that the theory thing is exciting, but they're just things that you know, I would find it hard to imagine doing without ontology. Chris?
Matthew, I think I agree with you mainly because I suspect I might have been one of the people who mentioned before about this distinction between incremental and disruptive. But I also think it follows another fault line in the applications, which is applying ontology to existing applications. And as you guessed, I have an interest in this with my legacy modernization work, and applying it to new, because I think theory is trying to be something that wasn't done before. Whereas I think, you might argue legacy modernization has not been done before. Certainly the legacy system has been done before, and it's there. There are people who have tried in various ways to do legacy modernization has failed. So I think there are a number of interesting fault lines that are worth pursuing. One of the arguments I see for the legacy modernization type stuff, if you like, stuff that exists, is that it's extremely large. I mean, you've heard the argument before, maybe a lot of people have, but a significant number of the systems people work on at the moment are legacy systems. There are an enormous number of legacy systems out there, and there are issues about, if you like, how people are going to migrate them. So it's an enormous market. The problem is persuading people to do it in a different way. So I think there are different markets have very, very different challenges.
Chris, yes, this is Norman.
Sure.
Am I unmuted now?
Yes, you are.
Yeah. I agree completely. If you're trying to solve a market problem where there already exists market solutions, even disruptive solutions can be difficult to deploy because of the legacy systems that have people's experience, cost, capital, and knowledge and desire to do something new. It has to be overcome. That's monumentally difficult often. So, yeah, go ahead.
Norman, I think I'm actually talking about something slightly different, and I don't disagree with you. And I call it the Butterwife syndrome, which is probably not politically correct. There is probably, maybe it's a Scandinavian syndrome, is that I think the issue with legacy modernization is that people have tried and failed. I know one of the big banks, where they've been trying to do it for years, and you know that when you're appointed to the legacy modernization project, you're going to be fired, you know, within 6 months because it's going to fail and you're going to be blamed. So I think the issue for me is not that so much that there is an existing application that you're trying to replace. It's more that people have got to the stage where they don't believe it can be replaced. There is, however, a side to it, which is, I think, that if you can prove, and this happens a lot, which is in terms of what you're saying, if you can prove that you can do it, then a lot of people's investment in their knowledge and their skills becomes devalued. So you've actually got an emotional problem when you're trying to sell it, because you're trying to undermine people's self-respect. And I think that is, which is, in a sense, the same argument you were deploying earlier, which is there was an existing legacy, there was an existing solution in place. So I think there is an element of, if you like, having to work against people's self-respect, but I think there is another problem. If you've got a solution to something that even you can't be fixed and just work around, it is difficult to persuade people to listen, because if you like, emotionally and mentally, they've closed it off. They've said it's something that doesn't work. And it links into Peter's comment about the structure of scientific revolutions. In there, I think one of the key signs of a paradigm is that you're told that there's certain things that the current paradigm doesn't fix, and you're told to ignore them and not worry about them. And I think in the second book, The Essential Tension, he actually says people react quite emotionally when you try and raise it. They have an emotional response to it. They're not prepared to look into it. So I think there are challenges. There are a series of different challenges when you try and push this through.
I agree. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I agree, and I mean, this is as old as if you read The Prince by Machiavelli, you know, any change threatening to the existing base, highly threatening and disruptive. So you can turn that around, just as my only point. When an SRI starts a venture, it's almost depending on that makes the venture successful. Because if you're entering a market, even an existing market, with a company that's starting with the innovation, you know, the disruptive solution, that doesn't have the legacy problem, then that company will rapidly grow, almost exponentially in the beginning. So penetrating the market becomes ever so much easier because everyone else has, the previous legacy systems, and they don't want to move away from it. By the way, that's a classic problem for all industry. I mean, in general, companies have huge difficulty moving away from their embedded systems, and look at what happened to Polaroid, look at what happened with Kodak, with chemistry, look at, all these companies. In fact, the lifetime of an average company these days, before it's acquired or actually goes under, in the Fortune 500, the Standard & Poor's 500, is less than 12 years. And that's because they can't change. They can't adopt the disruption.
Thank you. Pavisa, you unmuted? Call three.
Hello, I put my question there. I think selling the concept of ontology is... we're talking about the master data repository. That's a different concept. But when we talk about ontologies, we almost talk about, always talk about semantic technologies like RDF and all. Those are harder, newer technologies, and not main scale. Not everybody has adopted those, and they may or may not at this point. It's harder to sell the concept along with the technology tightly coupled, I think. That's one of the issues that I think is a problem.
I think I would agree with you. And I would not see OWL and RDF as being what an ontology is. They're not in the same, just like XML, they're not in the same layer. The implementation technology for ontology, but we've had other implementation technologies before, including things like SQL, for instance, which are quite widely used. Peter?
I'm bringing up yet another point, one of my sort of favorite policy-related arguments, which used to be prevalent in the U.S., maybe slowly going away. Wonder if it's affecting our colleagues in, for example, the U.K. and Europe. For those of us here in the United States, and if one goes back into history, shortly after the Second World War, Vannevar Bush started NSF, and sort of the paradigm that divides research into basic research and applied research, and saying that because basic research is strategic and sort of long money, government should do it, but when it comes to apply, then you should push that off to industry. And for decades, that was the paradigm until, I guess, the Donald Stokes book called Pasteur's Quadrant sort of brought up and highlighted the pitfall of that, because a lot of there's sort of at least one area of research that which he labels as the Pasteur's Quadrant, user-inspired basic research, that becomes more and more important. Actually, I think that the fact that the life cycle of from research to technology transfer to productization being squashed actually made this issue even more drastic. And I think that has been affecting some of the research policy in the United States. The case in point was the completion of the demo project funding by the Department of Defense here back in 2005, because they thought, I mean, they have done enough to stimulate the basic research so that industry can pick it up. Industry never did. So I was wondering if the UK or the European Commission still works along those paradigms, or it has sort of very quickly vanished and replaced by something a lot more applicable these days.
I think that certainly for the UK, the feeling is that we're quite good at doing the basic research, but we're not very good at taking it into the big wide world and applying it. And I'm not sure why that is and what it is. That's something which in the US you are thought to be very good at, is actually picking the ideas up and making them do something.
Okay, so along those lines, I mean, George Strawn, who is the director of the National Coordination Office for IT Research and Development, was at our opening launch event of this summit, since the NCO actually is one of the co-organizers. And George, I mean, in his slide, he actually asked, I mean, what should the government be doing at this time? I mean, increasing research support for ontology research or adopting ontology technologies for its operational work? Or how do we decide between the two for given problems and projects? And I guess George brought that up as a rhetoric question, because I mean we had this discussion before, and he is sort of well aware and a true believer that what we're dealing with belongs to the Pasteur's Quadrant. So I guess we will just have to pursue that. And in fact, in a more recent conversation, George actually pointed out that there are huge opportunities in two areas, which I think, I mean, during the course of this summit, we could try to address, maybe as a case example, or really bring it down to earth. I mean, and the two big opportunities, as they see it at the U.S. government, at least, are one, the what they call big data, the use of data in e-science, and how ontology can play a role in that. I mean, that's huge. And the other is in the electronic health record initiative, which is very well funded, along with other health and biomedicine, biomedical informatics use of ontologies. So these may be two areas that we could really get our hands onto these two uses. So on that, I pass it back to Matthew, maybe to wrap us up.
Yes, I think we've just about come up to 2 hours for this, so I see there are no further questions. So I need to say thank you to our panel speakers for those interesting, stimulating presentations, and to all of you who've contributed or just been listening in for your participation today. So thank you and good night.
Thanks, folks. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Great session.